In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, caffeine's effect on testosterone, meditation hacks, can kids eat more sugar than adults, how to fix plantar fasciitis, and much more.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power, speed, mobility, balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now. On the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
You know, it's a good thing you can't see me right now because I've got those horrible goggle marks because I just got back from the pool like 5 minutes ago.
Well, you know, the only thing that's like less attractive than horrible goggle marks all over your face when you like go out to dinner after you've been, say, swimming laps.
You look so wide awake and not ghoulish at all.
Yeah. The only thing worse than that is the blue light blockers, a.k.a. the birth control for your head. That's also a pretty bad look. But both are a better look than me right now. I've got a basically like chapped and peeling lips because
Have you been kissing?
Yeah. No, I got a massage. Okay, so here's why. I got a massage the other night. And you know how when you're face down on the massage table, you're all congested when you flip over and they want to work on your thighs and your stomach or your neck or whatever, and you're laying there like, gosh, I wish I could actually breathe through my nose. Well, my massage therapist was diffusing this essential oil. It's like clove, and it's basically like that thieves essential oil, right? Clove, cinnamon, rosemary, whatever, all these, quote, hot, unquote, essential oils in terms of their effect on the body. And I thought, hey, that's a perfect decongestion. So I smeared some all over around kind of like my lips underneath my nose, and it started burning within like 10 minutes. And I kind of had that, oh crap moment, and woke up and my lips were burnt to a crisp. So first world problems, burning your lips off during a massage therapy session.
That's definitely first world.
News flashes.
So the first thing that I wanted to mention today, because I know that all of the gentlemen listening in just want to get jacked. They want to increase testosterone. I'm pretty sure that we could just do every single show on boosting testosterone and we would still have listeners lined up.
We might even have more, actually.
Yeah. And then all of the women are sending their men to go listen to testosterone episode.
It's not a bad business model, actually. Maybe we should consider that.
No, testosterone is very sexy. Every guy doesn't want to lose testosterone. That's why it's an ancient ancestral practice to have consumed the balls of living creatures, I'm pretty sure. And I know this because I've driven through Montana and I've seen the Rocky Mountain Oyster Festival, and I'm pretty sure that the logical way that ancestral man would have thought would have been, hey, my libido is failing, I should eat some balls. I'm pretty sure.
Well, you know, the traditional way of castrating bulls is to like just sort of pinch off the sac and then bite it, like bite the sac and tear the testes out with your teeth. Oh. So really, it's not that far off.
See, with our Nigerian dwarf goats, we just tied rubber bands around their testicles.
Yeah, apparently that's really not humane. Like the best way to do it is like really quick and just like rip it out with your teeth. No. I learned that from Mike Rowe, everybody.
No, we just made a lot of people vegan. Anyways, though,
you're welcome, people.
If you don't want to eat balls, you can also drink coffee, because it turns out that in this latest study, there was a 70% increase in testosterone after the consumption of caffeinated gum versus a placebo gum. What they did was they measured the performance and the hormonal response, and this is important, to exercise, meaning when you exercise after having had dumped copious amounts of gum into your system, your testosterone goes up significantly. Mm-hmm. And there are two things that I should point out about this study, which I'll link to, by the way. All these studies, everything we talk about, I'll link to over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/380. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/380. What I should mention is that, A, they used a pretty copious amount of caffeine. This caffeinated gum was 400 milligrams in a, I don't know if it was a stick or a cube or a, I don't know, gum drop. But ultimately, that's like four cups of coffee. And
yeah,
that's a lot.
Well, at least two.
That's a lot of caffeine. And furthermore, even though testosterone went up, they also measured blood lactate. They measured, you know, repeated sprints. They measured cognitive function. And it didn't appear that there was much of a significant effect on actual performance, even though testosterone went up. Although I'm sure that there must have been some benefit
somewhere
of the testosterone. I mean, even if it was the fact that that one less animal had to lose its gonads because caffeinated gum was available.
That's a pretty good benefit. But
ultimately, interesting study. So try to chew caffeinated gum. And I don't know what brand they use, but I mean, there's a bunch of different brands of caffeinated gum. But try some before workout and see what happens.
Now, I'm wondering, does it have to be gum? Because I was taking some like caffeine and L-theanine combo capsules for a while, like just as a way to sort of refocus myself in mid-afternoon. Would that work, or is it the chewing action? Is that the,
well,
is the
I've,
delivery
yeah, I've
important?
Talked about this in some talks before about how chewing can increase blood flow to the brain.
Yeah.
And they've actually shown an improvement in cognitive function from chewing. And then we also all know that in the same way that ancient man ate the balls of living creatures, that the Vikings used to chew on like leather straps, hence that advent of like people using like performance-enhancing mouthpieces. Either way, it is possible that part of it is the clenching effect of chewing gum, except they did have a placebo gum group in which that did not happen. So throw that hypothesis out the window. So there we go. Chew some caffeinated gum before your workout. Here's another interesting one, glutathione. You know, I'm personally kind of interested in glutathione because you can get these genetic tests, right, to find out which things that your body could or should be producing, maybe isn't producing or doesn't have the proper genetic SNPs to produce enough of. And for me, one of those is the gene responsible for the production of something called SOD, or superoxide dismutase. What this means in a nutshell, and you can go, you know, get this tested at 23andMe or whatever, any of these genetic testing services, you know, DNA Fit, there's a bunch of them. But you can you can determine this. And then for me, this means that I need to pay close attention to my levels of glutathione. And I think four or five podcast episodes ago, we did a pretty extensive deep dive into glutathione and all of the different ways that you could increase glutathione, you know, from whey protein to liposomal glutathione to injectable glutathione. But what we didn't talk about was this study that just came out that investigated the antioxidant content of mushrooms. And this is the first time this has ever been studied. They found that mushrooms have very high amounts of something called ergothionine, which is an important antioxidant. And then also, an even more important antioxidant, you guessed it, glutathione.
Glutathione.
Yeah. So the mushrooms in this, they tested 13 different species, but the two mushroom types that had the highest amount of glutathione, if you wanted to start to kind of include these in your diet as a potent antioxidant, and again, I noted this for myself just because I personally need more glutathione, you got any guesses, Brock?
I would say those little guys, what the hell are they called? Oh, porcini.
Porcini, yeah. Bing, bing, bing.
That's like the most common mushroom, right?
Porcini and yellow oysters. Very high in glutathione.
Oh, yeah. Those are the ones that are all sort of flat and grody looking.
Yeah, which is kind of cool because mushrooms are a pretty decent source of vitamin D as well, especially if they've been exposed to sunlight. So,
with their furry parts up.
Yeah, another reason to add mushrooms to your diet. Oh, and speaking of sunlight, did you see this? This thing about sunlight. And what these researchers at University of Alberta did was they observed that a lack of sunlight actually makes your cells store more fat, with the idea being that the fat cells just beneath your skin, your subcutaneous fat, can shrink when it gets exposed to the blue light emitted by the sun. And the why this is supposed to work is that when the sun's blue light wavelengths, which is the form of light that you can see with your eye, penetrates the skin and reaches the fat cells beneath, The lipid droplets underneath the skin reduce in size and get released from the cells, so the cells don't store as much fat in people who have skin that gets exposed to the sun. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I thought that was really cool, but they didn't explain where that fat went when it left the cell.
Well, typically, if a lipid droplet is reduced in size, that typically means that, and this is probably why, to a certain extent, like infrared saunas can work for detoxification, is there is a lysing of the actual fat cell and a release of fatty acids into the bloodstream where they could, you know, theoretically be burnt as energy. What I think is even more interesting about this is people are walking around, again, wearing these blue light blockers at parties or in the evening watching movies or playing on their phone. And I think what's probably going to happen is a lot of people are going to get fat eyes.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's a terrible scourge of humankind.
Your eyes. Yeah, we're going to have a whole generation of fat eyes. People who sleep really well, but they're going to have super fat eyes. So, yeah, there's that.
We'll just look like those little aliens from all the movies from the 80s.
Yeah. And then finally, bacterial doping and poop doping could be the next big thing, according to this article that appeared in Outside Magazine. And this one was pretty interesting. They interviewed this guy named Embriet Hyde, who manages the American Gut Project. And one of the things that they're doing over the American Gut Project
that
is...
sounds like that's something totally different. American Gut Project.
What does it sound like?
Well, you know the country's known for its obesity, right?
Right. So, you're thinking like, I don't get it.
Going around poking people on their fat bellies or something.
Yeah, you need to go to the Canadian Humor Project and work on your gut jokes. So,
come on, it's funny stuff.
Anyways, they're testing 150 samples of the microbiome of the poop from professional athletes and from amateur athletes, and they're finding some very interesting things. Like, we already know that things like the spermicide-bacteroid ratio can affect, let's say, your propensity for obesity, and that there are certain bacteria that are responsible for certain personality characteristics or the propensity to gain or not to gain weight. And when we look at actual athletes in sports performance, it turns out that there are specific bacteria responsible for whether or not you're going to be superhuman, shall we say.
Mm.
So one of the things that they found was this type of bacteria, and they wouldn't name it in the article. They wouldn't name it publicly, probably because they want to turn it into some probiotic supplement that they can sell for copious amounts of money to the Chinese Olympians. But what happens is they tested marathoners, and they saw this bacteria blooming in large numbers of marathoners shortly after they finished the race. It accumulates in the bloodstream, and it accumulates after strenuous exercise, and it seems that it breaks down the metabolites associated with fatigue. Like, it could be an actual lactic acid buffering bacteria. And if there was, let's say, a really good endurance athlete who had that, you could potentially either dope with their poop, or if they were able to, formulate this bacteria supplement with said bacteria, which seems like a more promising business model compared to trading athlete poop. But either way,
you'd be surprised.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So they're doing all this meticulous testing on the personal microbiomes of different athletes. Another one that they found especially prevalent in endurance athletes was something called Prevotella. And they don't know why, but apparently people who are endurance athletes have a higher than normal amount of this Prevotella in their microbiome, especially in cyclists. And so this idea behind poop doping is that in the same way that someone with, say, like C. difficile or IBS or IBD or some other gut issue would, and people are doing this, there's clinics like the Tamount Clinic over in the UK. They're finding a healthy donor. They're getting the poop from that donor injected into their backside, or in some cases taking a poop pill. And it's literally just like rebooting their entire microbiome. Well, it turns out you could say, for example, hey, I'm an okay high level collegiate endurance athlete. I've got a roster here of 12 of the top athletes who have whatever sold their poop to, whatever we want to call it, poop clinic, and I can go and pay X amount of dollars to actually reboot my microbiome with their poo. I don't see anything going wrong with that scenario at all.
I have a total new side business right now. I'm going to go to all the marathons, sneak into the porta potties that are in the elite little tent area,
right?
Steal the poop, and then I'll just sell it out of the back of a van somewhere just nearby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it also helps to concentrate a lot of that positive bacteria when they sit there and fester in the hot afternoon sun as the marathoners run by. Yeah, perfect. Perfect business model.
$1 million idea.
Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a re-hit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com.
Listener Q&A.
Hi, I'm wanting to stop my brain thinking, actually surrender my thoughts during meditation. I find my thoughts just impact me just way too much. And I'm wondering what music you would recommend for me to listen to attain a higher a high state of consciousness.
This is likely the biggest hurdle that most people, when they start meditation, need to get over. It's keeping that mind quiet.
Let's just listen to this podcast because I'm injecting sublingual. Is that what it's called? Sublingual?
Sublingual. We're slipping things under people's tongues.
No, like what's the word? Subliminal.
Subliminal.
I was close with sublingual. Yeah, I just invented a new
sneaking
word.
Sneaking it under your tongue while you're sleeping. Your tongue.
No, subliminal messages are woven throughout this pod. You will focus. You will not lose focus or you will die. We will place blue light blockers upon your head. The thing is that I'm pretty sure this is a natural state, this brain wandering thing, because about every week I take my little boys, my twin 9-year-old boys, into our sauna, into our big infrared sauna. They should sponsor this podcast because I said that. Our big clear light sanctuary infrared sauna. Get it now with 4 easy payments of the
$29.99.
What we'll do though is I'll set up a candle that they stare at, right? That's sitting there on the floor that's flickering. I also have an hourglass that is a 15-minute hourglass, right? So you can watch the sand fall. And
it's a quarter hourglass.
What we practice on doing, yes, it's a quarter hourglass. What we practice doing is simply observing the flicker of the candle flame or observing the sand fall. And they'll generally go about 1 or 2 minutes before you start to see a fidget here, glancing out the window there, you know, kind of like elbowing brother to see what he does. And it's a very natural state. It's not like we popped out of our mothers, you know, just ready to go sit on a Himalayan mountaintop or go to a Vipassana, you know, 10-day silent meditation retreat. And so, yeah, we need some help. And for me, I guess maybe this is the way that I'm wired. Like, I'm always looking, like, there's a lot of articles about let thoughts go through your mind like a cloud. Or, do you like my voice, by the way?
You're so soothing.
So soothing.
I just drifted off.
Accept, and if the deep emotions persist, seek out the deep place from which they came. Like, a lot of that stuff is like, yeah, kind of sort of works. And I've taken a transcendental meditation course, right, where we talk a lot about that. And I interviewed the guy who taught me all my TM, Philip Land. And we discuss a lot of this in that show, this idea behind transcendental meditation and kind of like how to focus as you have this mantra going through your head. But, you know, I like to get down to brass tacks and kind of dwell upon a few of the things that we can do from a biohacking standpoint, so to speak. So one thing that I would recommend is that you want to set up your environment in terms of the senses that are around you to be able to focus better. And for me, that's sound and aroma are two biggies, sound and aroma. So for sound, what I mean by that, and I'll link to some of the interviews and some of the resources that I have on this in the show notes, is certain hertz frequencies that are played can induce a sense of concentration and a sense of focus because they induce alpha brainwave production and decrease beta brainwave production. They can also, some of them, depending on the hertz frequency of the music or the way that the instruments are tuned, also induce a theta brainwave frequency. This is why certain, you know, songs can make you feel really stressed out. You know, like if you listen to Slayer, you're probably going to get a little bit more beta brainwave induction. And if you listen to Enya, maybe a little bit more alpha, theta, or I just want to go punch my fist through the wall because this
song is driving me crazy.
Anyways, though, so two of the tracks that I really like, there's a company called Love Tuner. I get flack for this sometimes, but I actually have this little teeny tiny flute, like teeny tiny flute, like the size of like the cap of a pen. And you blow into it, ooh, and it blows at a frequency of 528 hertz.
It blows all right.
Which, among all of us woo-woo hippies, is considered to be the hertz frequency that opens up your fourth chakra, like your heart, right? It makes you feel these intense emotions of love. And they have a whole 60-minute track that just plays like these nice tunes at 528 hertz. There's another guy named Michael Tyrell who has two different albums, and I've interviewed him twice.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Once each about each of these albums. One's called Whole Tones and one's called Life, Love, and Lullabies. What I do is I have those on my MP3 player, and I can also hook them up via the auxiliary cable in the sauna and play them on the surround sound speakers in the sauna, which you can get for four easy payments of
$29.99.
And anyways, though, I will play those tunes inside the sauna, and as soon as they come on, you get this deep sense of focus and calm and well-being.
And you wet your pants.
And you wet your pants. No, that's only at 666 hertz.
Oh, that's the brown note.
I think that's the evil. That's the mark of the beast. If you played at 666 hertz, horrible things happen. You get chapped lips. Anyways, though, so I would recommend that you pay attention to sound. And there are even apps such as, say, the SleepStream app. That's one that I really like. I actually will sleep with that app. My wife gets really jealous. But I sleep with that app quite frequently.
She's a very understanding woman.
Sometimes while I'm in bed with her, I actually have an app wife threesome.
Kinky.
Man, we're going to the gutter on this podcast. I am, at least.
Totally.
I totally did. I'm sorry about that, folks. Anyways, though, the thing with the SleepStream app is it's like a DJ. So you can choose like pink noise, white noise, brown noise, purple noise. I made that one up. Pianos, binaural beats that induce focus, that induce concentration, that induce creativity. So that's one that I really like. And then there is another one called Brain FM. So these are like tunes that you can put into your ears. Brain FM is more sound based on artificial intelligence algorithms designed to induce creativity, focus, or sleep. And then the SleepStream app is just like a whole bunch of different things. And you can actually layer. They're not like an app that you can't play both at the same time. You can play both at the same time. So you can even mess around and layer them if you wanted to. So I'll put some of my favorite sound resources in the show notes. But then the other thing that I mentioned was, do you remember, Brock?
Aroma. That you mentioned?
Aroma. Smell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So some of...
Just don't rub it on your lips.
Yeah. Some of the smells that have been shown to increase focus and concentration. One would be rosemary. So rosemary is a very good one. I like that. Vanilla. Cinnamon.
Hmm.
And peppermint. And you can get an essential oil diffuser. Or you can just like carry around one of these little bottles and just like snort it, sniff it. Or if you go to my Instagram page, I actually have a little Instagram tutorial on how I make these aromatherapy diffusers for like pennies on the, no, not diffusers, they're inhalers, right? You get you go to Amazon, you get these little inhalers and they have a little cotton wick and you dip the cotton wick in the essential oil and then you put the cotton wick in the little glass container that the inhaler comes along with and you can sniff your essential oils. So anyways, though, any of these things like vanilla, peppermint, rosemary, cinnamon, those would be like the big four. I recommend those for assisting with focus and with not getting too distracted. You'd be surprised at like when you get the right music and you get the right smells, how much that can improve concentration. So a couple of other things I would recommend. First of all, if you do want to get into the woo-woo, there's one pretty decent article online about three ways to increase focus. And it kind of talks about things I haven't seen people talk about before, like to silently ask yourself a really big question before you meditate. So you actually have a goal that you're trying to get out of that meditation. It's like for me, one of the first things that I write in my journal when I get up is what truth did I discover in this morning's reading, right? And this Christian gratitude journal that I use every morning, because it allows me to read with some amount of cognizance, or at least more cognizance about what I'm reading, you know, versus just like, you know, picking eye boogers out of my eyes and trying to squint and figure out what it is that I'm staring at as I try to wake up. So same thing before you meditate, right? You'd want to silently ask yourself what you're actually trying to achieve. And then a couple other recommendations they have in that one is consider the idea that you're connected to the divine, which I think is interesting. And they kind of get into that in the article about how you're, you know, how you're like part of the vastness of the universe. And I'm not totally like a Taoist oneness of everything type of person. But at the same time, this idea that you really are doing something extremely divine and spiritual is a cool way to go into a meditation session and then marinate in the ideas. So basically figuring out what big ideas you're kind of pursuing, so to speak, during that meditation, then marinating in those ideas. Just basically, instead of letting the thoughts come and go like clouds, actually embracing the thoughts and kind of like, you know, not analyzing them, but letting them kind of fill your head, like welcoming them rather than feeling like you have to banish them. So, you know, we're getting kind of woo-woo, but those are a few things that I'd recommend when it comes
to... Well, when we're talking about meditation to begin with, I think getting a little woo-woo is kind of a given.
So sorry, people. Don't apologize. I know a lot of people don't like it when we use that word, so we'll try not to use it that much anymore.
What, meditation?
And then, honestly, like, when you look at books like Stealing Fire by Stephen Kotler and Jamie Will, where they talk about how, you know, things like microdosing with shrooms enhances spirituality and the spiritual experience, there's something to a lot of that. And... one of my go-tos for a day where I need more focus and more concentration, is not mushrooms, even though I will use those on occasion.
LSD.
Microdosing with LSD can also work. But let's say you don't want to go spend cryptocurrency and do illegal things. There's one supplement, and full disclosure, I support this supplement. I'm like an affiliate for them, but it's called Qualia. I also call it the God pill, and it's got some things in there that I've found really, really helped me with concentration and with focus, and specifically with not having like the monkey mind that jumps around from task to task. Like, I can just like hone in and focus and just like write for 2 hours without getting distracted, or focus on accomplishing one, like what I would call deep work or deep concentration. And some of the things in there make sense when it comes to inducing this effect, like lithium orotate, right? Lithium orotate is a neurochemical, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier and can have a pretty profound effect on your ability to be able to control like ADD and ADHD like symptoms. It's got choline in it, which acts basically on both the peripheral and the central nervous system as a choline donor to allow for a little bit more of like a stable thought pattern. You know, there are nootropics in there like huperzine and vinpocetine and theobromine and kind of a variety of things that play a variety of roles, you know, in terms of cerebral perfusion and neuroendocrine regulation, but also just the ability to be able to concentrate and focus. So I wrote a big article on this Qualia stuff, this stuff I call the God pill stuff. So, you know, if you wanted it to a supplement, we all know that you can just pop a pill and become a better meditator. So,
of course.
So there's that too.
I'm looking at investing in either a Biomat or the Normatec. I usually run 3 to 4 days a week, and I'm prepping for a 15-mile race. Didn't know how much anti-inflammatory effects the Biomat would have versus the Normatec. I've used the Normatec before. I've never been exposed to a Biomat. Thoughts from you, please.
It was kind of funny because are you familiar with Men's Health films, Brock?
I'm not.
They do like short films where they'll go and do like a day in the life of Rich Froning or day in the life of Laird Hamilton. And they decided yesterday to do a day in the life of Ben Greenfield. So they had their film crew show up at my house. And
wait, did you know they were coming? Or did
I did know. No, yeah, surprise.
Surprise.
Is it singing Telegram? No, we're going to follow you around the house all day with a video camera. Trust me, it'll be fun. Anyways, the thing that they thought was quite interesting was my napping habit, because after I finish lunch, I'll usually have like a big cup of something like reishi tea, you know, during lunch to kind of relax me a little bit. And then I'll go upstairs and I actually go upstairs before lunch and I turn on my Biomat. And then by the time I go up there after lunch, it's all warm, like a giant, warm, sleepy, cuddly bear. And that doesn't actually eat people or claw your face off. Yeah. Bears aren't actually cuddly, kids, just so you know. Anyways, though, so I'll heat up this Biomat, and then I have these boots next to it. So they're following me upstairs. I'm like, so I'm going to go take a nap now. And I roll out the Biomat first. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Biomat, basically you plug it into the wall, but it has what's called an EMF protector in it. So you're not getting exposed to a lot of like electricity from the wall if you're concerned about like sleeping next to an EMF source, if you're one of those Faraday cage people. Anyways, though, what it also has on it is it generates infrared light. So it's really great for you know, relieving muscle spasms or relaxing muscles or reducing inflammation or improving tissue oxygenation. It's like a heating mat without the EMF, but the heat comes from far infrared rays.
Cool.
So, which, you know, we don't even need to get into all the research behind infrared, and it's very potent anti-inflammatory. I mean, we can, if we want to, get into infrared.
We could. But I think it's been done, and I don't think it's even at question anymore.
No. There's multiple studies that show that infrared sauna devices and infrared light wave radiation producing devices are safe and effective for healing a variety of different inflammatory disorders. That has been studied extensively. So we know that infrared can be very effective for inflammation, for a host of other factors as well, but inflammation is really one of the biggies that it's been shown in clinical studies to actually reduce. So I lay down on my biomat, and then, and also, not to get too out there, it's lined, I got to make sure I say this with the right voice.
Okay.
It's lined with tourmaline and amethyst crystals embedded in the actual mat. And again, it might sound a little crazy, but when you look at trees, when you look at rocks, when you look at like sand on the seashore as you're walking barefoot on the beach, when you look at like all these like Himalayan salt lamps that hippies have hanging around their homes, when you have these like negative ion generators that are now built into HEPA air filters for homes, all of this is based on the concept of negative ions, meaning that the air that you breathe is actually, to a certain extent, electrified. You're actually breathing in ionically charged air, and one of the things that causes negative ions to be produced is minerals. That's why like Himalayan salt lamps produce negative ions. That's why rocks produce negative ions. That's why sand produces negative ions. When you breathe these in, they have a very beneficial effect on the cell membrane, on the electrochemical potential of the actual cell membrane. And so when you're sleeping on this, it's very similar like grounding or earthing, right? Same type of concept. It's like getting more in touch with our natural earth, because it's lined with a whole bunch of relatively expensive tourmaline and amethyst crystals, which is why like my kids have a biomat, and I think it was like $800, and I've got like the big full one, and it's like, you know, I think it's like $1,400, something like that. So it's not cheap, but it's pretty cool. Also, and I've got a video online about this, you can turn it into a sauna. You can actually, this sounds really silly, but if you have some of those like space agey silver, like Mylar thermal heating blankets, you can just lay down on your biomat and wrap a couple of those around you, and you break into a full on sweat within like 10 minutes. So if you wanted to use it as a sauna, you totally could. Anyways, though, so I lay down on my biomat, and these guys are filming me, and I'm not done yet. Because then I reach down beside the bed.
Leslie's getting old as this question gets answered.
And I pull out these boots that are designed by a bioengineer who I've interviewed on the show, but they're called Normatex, right? And like normally if you wear compression, let's say tights, like your tight pants, you get your tight pants on.
Tight pants. No, skinny jeans.
Tight pants on. My pants are the tightest in the land. Anyways, though, that helps to transport some fluid out of your limbs, but these things actually plug into a device that pumps air in and out of the boots. It's called sequential pulse technology. So it starts at the bottom of your feet and squeezes all your veins and your lymphatic vessels up towards your heart using this pressure, and then after it's pulsed pressure up towards your heart, it returns back down to the feet and then does it again. So it's just like a massage, right, for your both legs. They also have an attachment you can use in your hips. They got attachment for your arms that makes you look like a silly. Who's the big the guy on the cover, like the big puffy white guy on the cover of like Bread and stuff like that? Is that a good enough
description? The Michelin Man?
Not the Michelin Man. There's another guy. He's like the Michelin Man.
The Pillsbury Doughboy?
Yes, you look like the Pillsbury Doughboy. When you put on, thank you, Brock. I need my pop. I need my pop culture help on this podcast. Anyways, though, and a lot of studies have been done on that, an improvement in arterial resistance and upregulation of what are called PG1 or PGC1 alpha, an enos, which produce nitric oxide and enhance flexibility and decrease soreness. So I figure, what the heck? If I'm going to go up and lay on my bed for 20 to 45 minutes after lunch and take a nap, I want my body to just be getting as good as possible during that nap. So I lay down on my biomat and I pull my Normatec boots on, and then I pull a sleep mask over my face. And I don't know how long they filmed me just laying there, because when I took off my sleep mask and opened my eyes, everybody was gone. I was dead to the world. But to answer Leslie's question, first of all, if you really want the full meal deal, the Cadillac of recovery, do what I do and use both at the same time. Both. And I also do this, don't laugh, naked, because infrared doesn't penetrate clothing very well. That's why if you're doing like Juve lights or, you know, infrared sun or anything, you want to wear as little as possible, if that's at all possible. So I did keep my shorts on for the men's health thing. But ultimately, you want, when you lay down, like when you lay down to take the nap, like try to take off your clothes. So anyways, Leslie, when it comes to anti-inflammatory, if you had to choose one, the biomat, just because the Normatec boots don't, those don't really decrease inflammation. They kind of pump it out of the legs. But as far as like a really good anti-inflammatory boost, I would say the biomat. But if you're a true, true, real biohacker, both.
Hey, Ben and Brock, it's Tim Hoover. I've been a longtime listener of the show, about 3 years now. I thoroughly enjoy everything you guys put out. You helped me live a better life through, obviously, the things you recommend. So I have a question for you. I have three kids, ages 10, 12, and 14, that are very active. But a few years ago, whenever I switched over to whole, clean eating, I switched to everybody in my house. And so my kids, they don't eat processed foods or sugar. And I'm just curious, does the sugar really matter? How much sugar is okay for kids? And should I be letting them eat some processed food or some snacks, as high energy as they are? Would they burn it off? Or am I doing things right or wrong? Because my kids seem to be shorter than the other kids, and it could be genetics. I don't know. I'm just wanting to make sure that I'm feeding my kids properly and helping them grow to be the best little superhumans they can be. Thanks, guys.
Brock, how much sugar do your children eat?
Not very much. Mm. Because I don't have any.
They don't exist.
Children.
They don't exist. Yeah. That's the way to do it. Then you just don't need to worry about these things at all. Well, the fact is that in our day and age, normally I would say what I kind of get into in my book, Beyond Training, that kids are not just little adults. And kids, and especially growing kids, who might also be strenuously exercising or at least relatively physically active, which is what I would assume the majority of the children who belong to listeners of this podcast would be, they're not little adults. They've got a lot of different defining physiological characteristics that make them different than the older population. And I get into this in my book about how, for example, we see higher fat oxidation rates in exercising children. Exercising children actually are better fat burning machines, possibly because they've just had less a period of time of their lives to be eating cereal and scones and biscotti and sugar. So they haven't switched out of that fat utilization. But it turns out that they actually oxidize 10 to 40% more fat during exercise compared to adults. Now, does that mean they need less carbohydrate? Not necessarily. But it does mean that because of their high fat oxidation rates, we should be taking into account the fact that they do need a decent amount of fat in their diet, possibly even more than many adults. Now, they also burn lower amounts of storage carbohydrates, meaning children don't yet have the level of enzymes that are necessary to break down muscle or liver carbohydrate, what we call glycogen, to fuel as fast as an adult can. And so what this means is that giving a child during very intense glycolytic efforts some exogenous source of carbohydrate, right, like actually giving them sweets to fuel intense efforts, could be something even more beneficial for a kid than for an adult. So actually having, you know, whatever, a healthy energy bar at, and when I say healthy energy bar, I mean paleo, gluten-free, lactose-free, dairy-free, raw. What did I miss? Soy-free. Whatever all those little labels are that everybody has on every energy bar nowadays, those ones. Give one of those to your child during their next soccer game. It actually turns out that kids actually need that type of exogenous carbohydrate intake during longer exercise sessions. Now, they have...
Wait, I'm going to stop you for a second. You said beneficial. It might be beneficial to give them one of these gluten-free, fat-free, soy-free treats, do you mean beneficial to their performance or beneficial to their health and well-being?
Glad you asked. Well, if a kid's running around, kids are pretty insulin sensitive. There's not going to be a big spike in, like, whatever, you know, pancreatic cell destruction from excessive insulin production in response to eating an energy bar while they're running around in the soccer field, right? Like, that's not something that you need to worry about. Now, we'll get to what, you know, happens at rest here in a second. But interestingly, it also turns out that during exercise sessions that aren't that long, about 75 minutes or less, they've actually found eating carbohydrates does not appear to give extra performance advantages for kids. Hmm. And specifically, this would be kids under the age of 16. Now, I know that all this is starting to sound kind of confusing. And ultimately, what that means is that for longer exercise sessions, like let's say a basketball game or a soccer game or a tennis match that you know is going to last longer than 75 minutes, your child, and especially because they can't break down muscle glycogen quite as well or liver glycogen quite as well, they're definitely going to benefit from exogenous carbohydrate sources. And you probably don't want a kid to be doing like the whole ketosis low carb thing during an event like that. If a child is competing in a sport that is 75 minutes or less, something pretty brief, something, you know, maybe it's just like a 500 meter swim at their swim meet or something like that. Doesn't appear that giving them a bunch of exogenous carbohydrates gives them much benefit. And in fact, because they oxidize more fat, you would probably be better served by sticking to seeds and nuts and nut butters and olives and avocados and a lot of these more kind of like Mediterranean fats. So a big part of it depends upon the length of the sporting session. So ultimately, big picture, to bring this full circle, is that if you got a kid who's in a sport and it's especially like a sport that's lasting longer than 75 minutes, make sure that you have some form of carbohydrate-based fuel to give them. If it's under 75 minutes, then a kid can actually do pretty well eating fat. You don't have to worry as much as the Gatorade Sports Science Institute would have us to believe about kind of, you know, making sure that they're just like constantly fueled with some form of carbohydrate. Now, that all being said, how much sugar is okay for kids when they're just like hanging out at the house, right? Because technically, whatever, kids have a higher metabolism, so maybe their blood sugar is not going to, you know, get as high because they're running around, you know, a lot more. And ultimately, in both children and adults, huge amount of variability. I mean, we know this from my interview with Rob Wolf and his book, Wired to Eat, about this research that they did in Israel, where people, based on their microbiome, vastly different responses in blood sugar in response to, say, like a banana versus a cookie. And they've also looked at other genes, not just the microbiome, but genes. Like there's one gene called G6PC2. And that decreases the pancreas's ability to detect sugar in the blood. And that would have a significant effect. And actually, people who would have a different form of G6PC2 due to that change in their DNA that, again, you could look for on a 23andMe test, that would predispose you to slightly higher levels of blood glucose. So you could actually have your child genetically tested. And I personally don't have any problems ethically with that. I think for me personally, the pros outweigh the cons. And you could find out, hey, does my child possess some of the genes responsible for higher than normal blood glucose or pancreatic cell destruction or higher than normal risk for type 2 diabetes? You could also just basically, you know, I know this sounds like biohacking your kid, but you could get a blood glucose monitor and just for like a week on your kid's typical diet, monitor their blood glucose and scar them for life because daddy is chasing them around with a needle to try the end of their fingertip. You know, ultimately, we're now coming out with some pretty cool infrared technology that could give you a decent idea of blood sugar levels. But ultimately, what I'm saying is we live in an era where you could quantify DNA and you can quantify microbiome and you can do like a blood glucose analysis and see what's going on with your kids' blood sugar levels. Do kids have higher metabolisms than adults? In most cases, yes. Are they running around a lot more? In many cases, yes as well. And so am I asking myself a lot of questions on this podcast so that I can respond
to
them?
You sure are.
What kind of questions are those called? Not a leading question. Why am I blanking on this? When you ask a question, but you know the answer, it's not a leading question. You know.
Rhetorical.
Yes, a rhetorical question. I think it's a rhetorical.
No, rhetorical requires no answer at all. It's just to make a point.
Yeah. And that's what I'm doing, right? I'm asking these questions in order to create a dramatic effect on this podcast. So what do I do with my kids? My kids, they get carbohydrates. They get sugar. And here's the way that I do it with my children. First of all, my kids understand that the main time that the body can have not a very deleterious response to the intake of carbohydrate is pre-exercise, post-exercise, or during exercise, when the insulin response is going to be blunted and your body's going to be pretty insulin sensitive and glucose transporters are going to be upregulated, et cetera. I've actually taught my children that concept. And so they will, a lot of times, when they get a sucker from Wells Fargo, when we go to the bank, or when they get when they go to like Awana's on Tuesday nights and they get new candy, like they'll actually save that. Like they'll bring it to school sometimes and down it before PE. They'll take it before or after jiu-jitsu. When I say take it, I make it sound like medicine. They'll consume it like Cookie Monster in the backseat of the car on the way home from jiu-jitsu. But they realize there's a time and a place when carbohydrates can be less damaging. In addition to that, I don't do with them as I do with myself when it comes to restricting carbohydrates completely until the end of the day. And that is because of children's rapidly growing bodies, the need for extra glucans for joints, the need for a little bit of extra glucose to go around from their rapidly elevated metabolisms. I mean, a typical day for my kids, out the door to school, running around at school, PE, recess, coming home, piano, jiu-jitsu, running around, chasing each other with Nerf guns, eating dinner, running around more, hanging from the yoga trapeze. I mean, they're honestly more active than I am in many situations. And so, for example, they'll come home from school and they'll grab like a brown rice cake and they'll put some raw honey and almond butter on that. Or they'll blackstrap molasses is another very nutrient-rich sweetener that we use. Organic maple syrup, right? They're making themselves. So now they're cutting their pancakes and their waffles that they make in the morning with a scoop of protein, which is a great strategy, but they're also using an organic maple syrup, right? A little bit more nutrient-dense than just, say something more sugary, less nutrient-dense.
Corn syrup.
Like an artificial maple syrup. Dates and figs. They do a lot of cooking with those. So ultimately, and when I say cooking with those, I mean, they actually have a cooking podcast and they actually make like cakes and sweets and things like that. And they'll use dates, figs,
they really do.
Blackstrap molasses, raw honey, organic maple syrup, like a lot of these nutrient dense sweeteners. So, I don't ban them from doing that, but I encourage them to do it when they're more physically active. They don't really have that kind of stuff when we're on like a long car ride, right? Like it's more like avocados and carrot sticks and things that aren't going to spike their blood glucose. So, full circle. I know I just went through a lot, but here's the idea.
Yeah, I had no idea you were going to like this question so much. You're totally lighting up on this one.
I want to write a book about kids someday, just about kids and how
you
they
should.
Work, how to make them, how to raise them, because I'm so wise. I have twin nine-year-olds. Obviously, I've cracked the code on successful children, obviously, because they're nine and they're not dead. Anyways, though, so full circle.
Full circle.
Long workouts, exceeding 75 minutes, make sure that your child has good, healthy carbohydrates on hand. Under 75 minutes, don't worry about it as much as all the other parents seem to be doing. At rest, long car rides, long plane rides, etc., do to your kids the same as you should do with yourself. Higher fat intake, moderate protein, low carbohydrate. Normal day when your kids are running around, being super active, don't shun carbohydrates, don't shun sugar. Make sure that they know the best time for them to be taking it in during the day is when they are being pretty physically active, not when they're sitting around reading or watching TV. But use nutrient-dense sugar sources, have them around, teach your kids the concept of nutrient density. And then if you really want to get into things hardcore, using blood glucose monitoring and DNA testing, figure out the actual genetic propensity to something like type 2 diabetes. And like if you've got a child with, let's say, a 40% higher than normal risk of type 2 diabetes, you may want to make a different choice in terms of the afternoon snack that you feed that child, aka, rice cake with raw honey versus avocado with olive oil and sea salt because of that kid's unique genetic predispositions. And the two best books to figure this out, in my opinion, excellent new book called Dirty Genes by Ben Lynch, and also the book that I already mentioned, Rob Wolf's book, Wired to Eat. Oh, and by the way, because my kids are twins and they were born at 4.5 pounds each, and twins are just technically a little bit smaller than other kids, they're also freaking like their mom, like super skinny, high metabolism, run around all the time. I don't think the fact that they're small is going to make that big of a difference, you know, aside from in terms of macronutrients, just, you know, overall calories, you know, maybe a little bit less, but all the rules I just outlined apply. It's just that, you know, big old whatever Bruce down the street who's kicking the pants off of the child growth chart may have a whole avocado, whereas your paltry, small, feeble little child only gets 3/4 of an avocado.
Poor kid.
Hey, Ben. It's Glenn here from Saskatchewan, Canada. I have a question for you today about plantar fasciitis. I used to be a pretty avid long-distance runner. I'd run about a half marathon 5 or 6 days a week. Never had any problems with my feet or anything like that. Then what happened was about 4 years ago, I switched from a very active career to a desk job. And when I did that, I gained about 20 pounds. And as soon as that happened, I got plantar fasciitis almost within, you know, like the first month. And since then, I have not been able to get rid of it. I've completely stopped running at this point. I haven't run for ages, for years. I'm able to go to the gym still, and I wear these padded shoes that have a ton of padding in them just to try to protect my feet. But even that, you know, the plantar fascia gets super inflamed and tight every single time I do anything. Even if I just go for a walk around the block, I'll get, you know, pretty extreme pain in my heel and even up into my ankle. Just wondering if you have any advice for how to get rid of, you know, a case of plantar fasciitis like this that's been sticking around for quite some time. Cheers.
Brock, you've been dealing with this a little bit, yeah?
I have, but I was under the impression that it wasn't fasciitis anymore. They didn't call it that. It was a fasciopathy.
Oh, fasciopathy.
That's the new way to refer to this injury.
Yeah, interesting. I actually did not know.
Because it's not an inflammation.
Fasciopathy. So it's a pathological fasciopathy. What's supposed to be the difference between fasciopathy and fasciitis?
Semantics.
Yeah. Because, I mean...
No, it's apparently because it's not a true inflammation. Like, itis refers to something being inflamed, but it's not necessarily that your plantar fascia is inflamed. It's that it's aggravated.
Yeah, I was under the impression that, like, apathy, right? Like, a pathological condition was something that, like, is manifesting itself in some kind of... Like a pathy describes the actual pain, like... I have, you know, plantar fasciopathy, which means that not only do you have inflammation, like it covers that, but also you have pain, you have limited range of motion, like it's a pathological condition versus just say like plantar fasciitis, which might be inflammation of the plantar fascia that's, you know, non-symptomatic or asymptomatic. I don't know.
Yeah. I actually tried to ask my, I have a really smart chiropractor that I go to see quite often. I tried to ask him the difference, and when I said it was plantar fasciopathy, he actually sort of waved his hand dismissively in my face and shook his head.
Impossible.
And he didn't.
Impossible.
He did not want to discuss that. So apparently it's not a big deal.
He probably just wanted to adjust T5 and T6. That's the answer to everything in a chiropractor's office. That's your thoracic, but my upper neck, not your thoracic, but my lower, not your thoracic. I'm just kidding.
But it's my toe.
I actually love chiropractic docs, most of them.
Me too.
There's a few weirdos out there, but... Most of them are actually pretty cool. I have a lot of friends who are chiros.
Some of them are full of...
Yeah. Anyways, so we digress.
Yes, we totally went off track.
First of all, I'm not going to go over all the stuff that you've tried, Glenn, because you tried a lot. Like, I could tell you how to, like, buy the frozen juice cans at the grocery store and roll those under your feet and how to, like, you know, get a night support brace, which in my opinion works really well, and how to do the little exercise where you pick up the marbles with your big toes and drop them into the cup, or scrunch up the towel and then extend it with your toes.
Scrunching up the towel,
sounds like you've kind of done all of that, bro. I'm not going to insult your intelligence. I'll fill you in on a few of the things that you may want to try that you haven't yet. First of all, one of the things that you could do is just break up the tissue. And there's some pretty interesting studies on the ability of something called pulsed electromagnetic field therapy to kind of act similar to almost ultrasound in terms of not just increasing the uptake of oxygen into pathological, see what I did there, tissue areas that are inflamed, but also to do things like induce heat shock proteins to reduce some tissue damage, to increase ATP production, stimulates what's called myosin phosphorylation, and the actual hertz frequency. There's one device that I like because it's small and would fit almost perfectly underneath your heel. It's called a FlexPulse, and that one has a setting where it goes back and forth between 10 hertz and 100 hertz. That would be a pretty good one to consider using on the foot. So if you haven't used PEMF yet, definitely look into PEMF. Another one, and I had this done on my psoas, and Gabby Reese down in Kauai.
Did you say your sore ass?
Yeah, my sore ass. Gabby Reese down in Kauai hooked me up with this girl named Angie down there, who Angie Mueller, I forget her website's name, you could probably look her up, in Kauai, and she did dry needling on me. And dry needling is something that actually has been looked at for inflammation of the plantar fascia. And if you don't know what this is, it's an actual, just like it sounds like, it's like a long-ass needle that's so small that it doesn't really hit the nerves too much, but you definitely feel like a slightly uncomfortable amount of pressure from it. But they kind of put it into specific areas to reduce inflammation and to reduce pain. Like a treatment on your plantar fascia would take like maybe 15 minutes. And they've shown that this can actually, I mean, it's essentially just repeated puncturing of your tissue with an empty hypodermic needle, that can have a really effective effect, a really effective effect on the plantar fascia. And actually, they combine that with in one study with ultrasound guided steroid injections. Which I actually, this is like similar to what I did with stem cells, where they went into my hip and they used ultrasound digital thermography to identify the areas, and then they put the needle exactly where the area is. They can do that same thing with your plantar fascia. They could do that with in this study they use steroids, but you could probably try it with prolotherapy, with PRP, with stem cells, any of those. But you'd want an ultrasound guided injection, so you put it exactly where it needs to go. But this is another thing that you could look into, would be dry needling, preferably with some kind of a thermography to image it. Similar to PEMF, there's also this thing called extracorporeal shockwave therapy. Same thing I did to my down at Gainswave. You could probably have them do your foot at the same time if you wanted to.
You probably don't want to, though.
And it's high intensity acoustic sound wave therapy that breaks open old blood vessels and builds new blood vessels. And you can use that on plantar fascia. And this is another one that they've studied and that they've used and they found efficacy for. A little bit more expensive. I mean, you're looking at $500 up to $3,000 for shockwave therapy, and sometimes two or three treatments of that. But, you know, if it's just like a bane in your side and you can't walk, I mean, it's something you could look into.
It's not that expensive here anyway in Canada. Like I paid $65 for my physiotherapy appointment, and they just like did that because they thought that was what I needed.
But you've also been paying taxes out the ass since you were 18 years old. And
sorry, I wasn't trying to compare our medical system to the American medical system. I'm just saying it's not, I don't think you have to pay the $500.
Oh, you've paid for it. Like someone is paying for it. You want to have this debate right now? We could throw down right now.
No, that's not what I meant to start.
Nobody wants to hear Ben, who basically wants to privatize healthcare completely. Anyways, that's just me. I digress. So I've not only lost several podcast listeners, but also created vegans out of the ones who don't want to think about tying rubber bands around animals' testicles. We're on a roll. Okay, two of the things I would look into. First of all, you can order these peptides to your house for like pennies on the dollar. Two, and very few studies behind these. This is more of like a go to the bro science bodybuilding forums, and a lot of people have used it for this. And I've written articles on this. They're called peptides, and they can repair tendon, they can repair muscle. Actually, it's like a poor man's prolotherapy or a poor man's PRP or a poor man's stem cell. BPC-157 and TB-500. Those sound like robots out of Star Wars, but they're actual peptides that you can inject into a joint. So those two I would consider too. And the problem is there's not a lot of loose skin to inject those subcutaneously around the plantar fascia. But if you get them even close to the area of pain and you've got some skin to pinch, you can get them subcutaneously up around in there. And go
hopefully you've got a fat heel there, Glenn.
Well, as long as your heel isn't getting exposed to the sunshine, it probably is fat. We know that.
There you go.
Today's newsflash. And then finally, there is this study about high load strength training improving outcome in patients with plantar fasciitis. Mm-hmm. And in this study, they actually had these people doing heel raises with the towel underneath the toes. It's essentially almost like a eccentric, same thing that they did with Achilles tendonitis back in the day. You know, ironically enough, it appears that loading the Achilles and doing like eccentric light muscle tearing on it actually helped to realign a lot of those fibers. The same thing. In this study, they actually did high load strength training and high load, essentially like like an eccentric, it would be eccentric plantar flexion in these patients with plantar fasciitis. And they did this every other day, right? So about 48 hours for recovery, and actually found that to have a pretty decent effect as well. So
that's actually what's working the best for me on my plantar fasciitis. As soon as I introduced that, I did a series of about 3 weeks of doing it every single day, and it just pissed off my plantar fascia, like made it worse. But now I've backed off to every second day, and it's almost like magic. Like I barely have a slight ache in there now.
Mm. Well, really, if that doesn't wind up working, you could diffuse essential oils down by your foot, like vanilla, peppermint, and you could play them heart chakra lullabies, and it would probably heal up the pain.
Oh yeah,
and they probably have a double blind clinical gratitude. Study about that. Practice gratitude too. It's really good.
I'm so grateful to my heel. Fascia.
All right, before we offend people, let's give something away, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is the part of the show where if you email gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com, that's gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com, and you let us know your t-shirt size and we read your review. There's a lot of hoops to jump through. We read your review.
There's a lot of,
but you go leave a review. We read it here on the show. And if you hear it read and you email us with your t-shirt size, we send you free shit. Okay. That's what I'm trying to say.
Beep.
So. This one's called Getting Reacquainted with Biology. 5-star review by Scooter Jones. Scooter Jones.
I love that.
I hope his name really is Scooter. His name, Scooter. All right, take it away, Brock.
All right. It goes like this. Ben presents information as a trained expert, although he's a total a-hole.
Hmm.
Oh, no, wait, that's not what it says. Sorry. Ben presents information.
You woke up on the funny side of bed this morning.
As a trained expert, but with the open mind of a perpetual student. It's actually a really nice compliment there. You're a perpetual student, Ben.
Just didn't graduate ever.
There's no graduation ceremony for you. His education and background provide a solid backbone to measure different health, fitness, and wellness trends and tactics against. While his curiosity and courage to try fringe techniques and report back on their results benefits the greater good. Oh, nice. Hmm. You benefit the greater good. I've enjoyed the ride so far, as well as getting reacquainted with words I thought I had left in my last biology class I took. That's awesome. Thanks, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, like reinvigorating that bio 20.
Yeah, I want to know one of the new words that he learned. How about one of those doozies that I threw around today, like sublingual or subliminal, or what's another good one from today's show, Brock? There was that last one, hypothetical, as in a hypothetical question. Hey, Brock, is this podcast over? Yeah. Should we probably go? Yeah. Did I enjoy talking to you? Yeah, probably.
That's just call and response now. Yeah. That's not even.
All right. Later, dude.
Are we done?
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.